Today's sutta is called the Maha Gosenga Sutta. Gosenga is a place. So this is the greater sutta at Gosenga. And again, the reason I have chosen the sutta is just simply because it hasn't been done before. So I always reckon it's nice to do things that we haven't done before. You get a kind of very broad overview of the Dhamma, all the different aspects of Dhamma. And sometimes there are certain suttas you tend to pass them over because you don't think that they're interesting or whatever. And then when you start to read them, you actually find out there's something interesting. Pretty much, it's pretty hard to find a sutta which is not interesting. And if it isn't interesting, very often it is because perhaps it is a later addition. The Buddha said it. Usually, it's usually quite interesting. But if you read kind of other things, then it might not be so interesting. So this is how this sutta goes, and as usual, we will just go through it and stop at relevant places. And please, if you want to ask questions as we go along, please do so. Okay, greater discourse in Gosenga. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the park of the Gosenga Sala tree wood, together with a number of very well-known elder disciples. The Venerable Sariputta, the Venerable Mahamoggallana, the Venerable Mahakassapa, the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Revata, the Venerable Ananda, and other very well-known elder disciples. Right, so this is the cream of the disciples, right? I mean, here you have the collection of the best ones all packed together. So that already makes the discourse a bit interesting, right? You've got all the best disciples there, and together with the Buddha himself. Then, when it was evening, the Venerable Mahamoggallana rose from meditation, went to the Venerable Mahakassapa, and said to him, "Friend Kassapa, let us go to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma." "Yes, friend," the Venerable Mahakassapa replied. Then the Venerable Mahamoggallana, the Venerable Mahakassapa, and the Venerable Anuruddha went to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma. Yes, sorry. I think this will come later on in the sutta, but basically he was a meditator, a secluded, very secluded monk. There isn't that much about him, as far as I know, in the suttas. As far as I can remember, he is not talked about that much. I think he was a Sakyan. I think he was part of the Sakyan clan, so I think he was a relative of the Buddha, if I remember correctly. But I'm a bit vague on the details, unfortunately. But yeah, but we'll see later on. Later on he will talk about his... all these disciples will say something here, so we get a bit of feel for who they are, etc. Yeah. The Venerable Ananda saw them going to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma. Thereupon he went to the Venerable Revata and said to him, "Friend Revata, those true men are going to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma. Let us also go to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma." "Yes, friend," the Venerable Revata replied. And then the Venerable Revata and the Venerable Ananda went to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma. Very repetitive so far. And again, you can see here that, of course, is because of the oral tradition. So it's easier in an oral tradition to repeat things verbatim, right, again and again in the same way, because it's much easier than having to make small changes, adjust small things from, you know, passage to passage. Yes, sir.
Is that someone special that I should know who they are already?
No, not really. The reason we are here is to be able to ask questions like this, so it's wonderful. Please ask questions. Don't ever feel ignorant or feel any question is too simple or whatever. No, it does not refer to the Buddha. These are the Buddha's kind of main disciples. So most people have been around for a while, I should say, will recognize these names quite quickly. Yeah. So the Buddha had two chief disciples. One was the Venerable Sariputta, another one was the Venerable Mahamoggallana. They were the two chief disciples. And they were distinguished in two different spheres. So Venerable Sariputta was the one who was chief in wisdom. And the Buddha would often say about him, if anybody else is going to turn the wheel of the Dhamma, in other words, going to keep propagating the Dhamma, Buddhism, he should do it if I'm not around. So he almost placed Venerable Sariputta on the same level as himself in terms of wisdom and understanding. And the other one is Venerable Mahamoggallana, and he is the chief disciple. He was distinguished for his psychic powers. So he could do all kind of, you know, wonderful and marvelous stuff through psychic powers. So these were the two chief disciples. And the other disciples here, you maybe quickly go through them as well, because you have a point, actually. We should actually probably have a look at these disciples. Then there's Mahakassapa. And Mahakassapa, he came to prominence after the Buddha passed away. So after the Buddha passed away, they had what they call a council, which is not really a very good name. It's more like a communal recitation. It would be a better translation of the term. Sangiti is the Pali term. It literally means singing together or chanting together, is what it means in Pali. So they had a communal recitation of the Dhamma that the Buddha had taught. And the idea there is they wanted to preserve the Dhamma after the Buddha passes away. They don't have any authority anymore, so they need somehow to preserve the Dhamma that has been taught. So they come together and chant it, and the presiding monk at that recitation, communal recitation, was Venerable Mahakassapa. So he is very famous for that, and he was also quite famous for his austerities. We'll see that later on. So that's him. Then we have Venerable Anuruddha. Venerable Anuruddha was also one of the most famous disciples of the Buddha. He came from Buddha's family, extended family. They were known as the Sakyans. The Sakyans was a small tribe in India at the time. They were part of a larger kingdom. These were the Sakyan people. They're called Sakyaputta, the son of the Sakyans, because they belonged to the Sakyan tribe. And he was famous for his what is known as the divine eye, which is like, if you like, maybe it would be called clairvoyance in the present day. You know, he could see like galaxies and other worlds and all kind of wonderful and marvelous stuff. So that was his claim to fame. And then there is Venerable Revata, which Huitong just mentioned, which I don't know that much about. And then Venerable Ananda, who was the Buddha's chief attendant. He was the attendant of the Buddha for the last 20 years of his life. And he was famous for his memory, because he had to memorize all the suttas that the Buddha gave. So at the communal recitation after the Buddha passed away, Venerable Mahakassapa, he was the one who was presiding over the council, but Venerable Ananda was the one who recited all the discourses that the Buddha had given him. Okay, so that gives you a rough idea who they are. There is actually a book in the library here called The Great Disciples of the Buddha, which has long chapters about all the main disciples of the Buddha, many, many more that I have mentioned right here. That's quite a nice book, actually. Bit of it is mythology and legend, but some of it is may have a more historical basis. Yes? Yeah.
Is it true that the Buddha exchanged rope with Venerable Mahakassapa and shared half of his diamond throne with him?
I think the story of swapping robes, I think, is maybe correct. That's found. Where is that found? In the Vinaya, I think. Found in the Vinaya somewhere. Can't remember now where it's found. Somewhere in the Vinaya it is found. The one about the diamond throne, no, that must be much later. There's nothing about the diamond throne anywhere in the suttas.
Namely his seat.
Yeah, the seat that he used for his awakening, yeah, right?
Or whatever his seat is now, come share half.
Yeah. I don't think there's any kind of reference to that, as far as I know, in the suttas anywhere.
Okay.
That must be a more legendary, mythological thing here.
Okay, I mean, yeah. To give perhaps later credence and authority for him to preside over the recitation.
Right, yeah, that's what often happens, isn't it? They have to be kind of given the authority, and that kind of, you create a story to give them that authority. Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
And is it true that Venerable Anuruddha was blind?
No, I don't know any basis for that.
Yeah. So his physical eyes are intact?
Yeah, as far as I know.
Because from the Chinese tradition, was said that he was blind.
Really?
Yeah. Because he was chided by the Buddha from the Chinese tradition.
Then
he strove.
Yeah. Okay.
And then went blind because of the striving.
Okay.
And then the Buddha taught him the divine eyes.
So he could see through all the means. Okay. Okay. There's nothing about
that. That's why I want to know what is mythology and what is historical.
Yeah. Okay. So they are all going to the Buddha together, to Venerable Sariputta, to hear the Dhamma. And an interesting little phrase here, friend Revata, those true men, it says here, those true men are going to the Venerable Sariputta. And the Pali word for that is Sapurisa. And Saporisa means like basically means like a good man or a superior person, right? It doesn't necessarily even mean a man, but a superior person. And this is how I think Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it now. He calls it a superior person. And this basically it is a synonym for the Aryans, those who have actually seen the Dhamma, those who have understood the teachings directly. Saporisa is the Pali word for that. Good, the superior person is a good translation for that. Okay, so they're all going. And then what happens next? The Venerable Sariputta saw the Venerable Revata and the Venerable Ananda coming in the distance and said to the Venerable Ananda, "Let the Venerable Ananda come. Welcome to the Venerable Ananda, the Blessed One's attendant, who is always in the Blessed One's presence. Friend Ananda, the Gosinga Sala tree wood is delightful. The night is moonlit. The Sala trees are all in blossom. The heavenly scents seem to be floating in the air. What kind of bhikkhu, friend Ananda, could illuminate the Gosinga Sala tree wood?" Right? So here they're all coming, and it's obviously it's an inspiring night. I don't know if you have been out when it's moonlit. It doesn't really work so much in the city, but if you are in the forest or in the country when it's moonlit, it's very inspiring, right? You get this light, this kind of yellowish light, there's long shadows everywhere, and it's very kind of, it's a kind of magical feel to it when the moon comes out and it's absolutely full moon. And you know, it often gives you extra inspiration. And sometimes it makes you go a bit mad, right? That's when you have the werewolves and this kind of stuff on the moonlit nights. So it has a kind of two sides to it. You get the bad inspiration or the good inspiration. But it's very, you can see that this is obviously a very, very beautiful night. The Sala trees are all in blossom, right? All the flowers coming out. And there's obviously a scent from these Sala trees. I'm not sure exactly what that would be like, but so obviously a very nice and inspiring night. It's nice to talk about something inspiring. So he asks Ananda, "What kind of monk would illuminate this Sala tree wood? You know, what kind of would give extra kind of extra inspiration to this Sala tree wood? What sort of person would that be?" It's always nice here how when the Sariputta says, you know, the Ananda, who is the Blessed One's attendant, right? He was well known, Venerable Sariputta, for having this sense of gratitude to people. And there is a nice sutta somewhere where I think the Buddha asks, there's a man who comes and he wants to ordain. And he asks the monk, says, "Well, you know, should we ordain this monk?" And the monk said, "No, we shouldn't ordain him. You know, he has never done anything. You know, he's kind of not a very nice character or whatever." That's basically what they say. It's kind of strange. And then Venerable Sariputta says, no, I remember one time he offered alms food to us, you know, he offered alms food on alms round. And because of that, he should definitely be ordained. He did something kind. So Venerable Sariputta, who is the wisest person in the Sangha, he also, of course, has a sense of gratitude, right? And he remembers these things. He's a very wholesome character, Venerable Sariputta. Another story with him is when he, this is also in the suttas, when he goes out and his robe is falling off a little bit. And then there's a novice, right? A novice, maybe just 12 years old or something, a tiny little kind of whippersnapper. And then he says to Venerable Sariputta, who is this, one of the greatest monks, right, next to the Buddha himself, says, "Oh, you know, Venerable, your robe isn't properly put on." So obviously has a bit of nerve, this little novice. And then Venerable Sariputta kind of, you know, changes his robes, puts it on nicely. And then he goes afterwards and says, "Thank you, teacher," to this novice, right? It's kind of, it's sort of amazing. Here is kind of this very wise person, but very, very humble and very, has this beautiful personal characteristics. And there is a sutta in the Gyutra Nikaya where it says that gratitude and thankfulness is always a characteristic of a superior person, the Saporisa. And lack of gratitude and lack of thankfulness is always a characteristic of the inferior person. So very, very nice there. So he remembers this of Venerable Ananda. He is the Venerable, he's the Buddha's attendant, right? And he obviously has a sense of gratitude about that. And he invites him specifically for that reason. So he then asks him, "What kind of monk would illuminate the Gosinga Sala wood?" And he replies, "Here, friend Sariputta, a bhikkhu has learned much. Remembers what he has learned and consolidates what he has learned. Such teachings as are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, in which affirm a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Such teachings as these he has learned much of, remembered, mastered verbally, investigated with the mind, and penetrated well by view. And he teaches the Dhamma to the four assembly with well-rounded and coherent statements and phrases for the eradication of the underlying tendencies. That kind of bhikkhu," in other words, that kind of monk, "could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood." So, of course, Ananda here is talking really about his own strength, right? This is his strength, is the ability to remember all the teachings. And it's interesting, when they are asked about what kind of monk would illuminate the Sala wood, they basically talk about their own strengths, right? Does that sound strange? Does that sound kind of, you know, self-centered perhaps? Or why are they talking about their own strengths? And I think it's simply the fact that, well, you know your own strengths, and you know that these qualities are good, that these are, you know, because you have seen it for yourself. It leads in the right direction. It leads to, you know, eventually to full awakening, etc., etc. So because you have direct experience with these things, I assume that is the reason why they talk about this. And of course, I cannot see that there cannot be any selfish motive behind this, but just to do with your familiarity with these things. So he has learned much and remembers what he has learned, right? Such teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Basically the teachings of the Buddha, right? This particular phrase can have many different meanings, but I think the main meaning is that the results of the practice is good in the beginning. In other words, it has a sense of removal of suffering and movement towards contentment and happiness in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end, very briefly. The right meaning and the right phrasing here. The phrasing is, the Buddha obviously very careful about how he phrases his teachings so that they can last a long time, and it is phrased in a coherent fashion. And the right meaning, in other words, it moves towards something worthwhile. The end point, of course, being the end of suffering here. And it is utterly perfect and pure. And this is really, I think, not the best translation. The Pali here is paripunna. Paripunna means complete. It is utterly complete. In other words, it doesn't lack anything. It has all the aspects necessary for taking you all the way to awakening. And it also is complete in the sense that the full path is there from the beginning to the end. I think that is a better translation here. And such teaching as these, he has learned much of, remembered, mastered verbally, investigated with the mind, and penetrated well by view. I think this is one of those very important things that you see in many places in the suttas. And that is the fact that when you hear the Dhamma, it is not just about hearing it, but it's about reflecting on these things. What do they actually mean? You know, what does it actually pointing to? It's too easy to sit there, take it on board, and then just leave afterwards and kind of forget about it. But to really understand these things, they need to be reflected over, pondered upon, right, again and again. And as you do that, it starts to sink in what is going on, right? It is not something that you should, it needs to be reflected on. And then it says here, so you remember this, master it verbally, investigate it with the mind, right? This is what reflection is all about. And eventually, when you keep on investigating and you keep on practicing accordingly, eventually you come to this thing which is called here, is penetrated well by view. And penetrated well by view really means to understand the teachings directly, immediately, through what you call the eye of wisdom, right? When you have a direct experience of these teachings. So that really means becoming an Arya, a noble one, a stream enter. That's really what it refers to, at least in the highest sense. Perhaps it also refers to other things in a slightly lower sense. So I think this is a very important thing, this idea that you need to reflect on these things. What does it mean? So what kind of teachings should you reflect on? Because sometimes the problem is that you know, you have this, you know, this here is only about 1,000 pages, 150 sutras. There's enough here probably for a lifetime of reflection. But then this is only one collection, right? Then you've got three more here. So you know, you can maybe be too scattered by reflecting on too many different things. That's one possibility. Yeah? So sometimes you need to choose carefully what kind of Dhamma you want to reflect on. And of course, the things that you should reflect on are those things that you need in your life. So what is it that you need to make progress on the path? Well, to understand that, you have to know yourself fairly well. How well is your meditation going? How well is your wisdom going? How well are all these factors going? And if you are the person, like most people, who, you know, use meditation to find a little bit of peace and satisfaction, who doesn't have very profound stillness and samadhi and all these kind of things. I mean, how many people have really, really profound samadhi? You know, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands or anything, but it's not that common. Let's face it, it's rare, right? So for the vast majority of people, you need to investigate those things that lead you to meditation, that lead you to improving your meditation, to go deeper, to get it more profound. That is what we mostly need to do. And so what are those things that we need to investigate to improve our meditation? Basically, it's virtue, right? Sila. It is all these things about avoiding the bad, doing the good, thinking the right way, avoiding thinking in the bad way. And one way that sila, the most perhaps comprehensive way that sila is explained in the suttas, is what is known as the Dasa Kusala Kamapata, the 10 pathways of wholesome actions. And this is found in Majjhima Nikaya in several places. I read out one of the suttas a few weeks ago called the Salayaka Sutta, I think. Yes, Salayaka Sutta. It talks about these 10 courses of wholesome action or 10 courses of unwholesome action. And that is in many ways the broadest and most profound exposition of virtue in the suttas. So for most people, I would say that is a very good place to start your investigation. Just investigate that. Think about what that means, to be virtuous. In the English language, to be virtuous often means avoiding the bad stuff, or morality means avoiding the bad stuff. In Pali, the word sila means conduct in a much broader sense, avoiding the bad, doing the good. Not thinking the bad, but thinking the good, right? It's very, very broad. It's about your whole character, development of your whole personality. So this is, you know, and look at those things. It's beautiful stuff, and it's very profound. There's so much information just in those 10 pathways of wholesome actions. And by working, just looking at that, investigating that, and making a very solid foundation for yourself on the Buddhist path, that will be the foundation that takes you into meditation later on. Okay. So that is what Venerable Ananda has to say. And of course, please, yes, please. Yeah. Yeah. Not quite.
Yes. I mean, as I understand this, this has to be strictly monk's talk. No layman can be present. Is that right?
In this particular case,
yeah.
Not really, because I think very often the Buddha would have spoken to, he was spoken to assemblies, and he would have spoken that in the assemblies would have been monks and lay people present. Perhaps what you're talking about is that monk's rule that you cannot teach to lay people. Is that what you're thinking of? No?
Because he's saying he's sharing his attainment.
Well, he's not really sharing a attainment. He's just saying he's teaching Dhamma, right?
I don't know. I'm asking.
Yeah, I think he's just. I don't think he's just. Yeah.
I suppose the layman would have loved to be present.
Yeah.
And by inference, they understand.
Yeah.
God. Okay.
I don't think they were. They may not have been in the layman present in this particular case because it seems to be a very monastic thing.
Yeah. That was why I'm asking.
Yeah. But I don't think that he's really sharing his attainments. I think he's just teaching Dhamma in a general sense. There's a difference. There's a difference there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But by any inference, any one of us here by inference knows that he's talking about what he knows. I mean.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's always like that, right? I mean, you know, you cannot talk. You cannot really speak without people inferring things about what you're saying. I mean, if somebody talks about the samadhi, and just from the way they talk, you will have some idea whether they have experienced it or not. You know, when I listen to Ajahn Brahm talk, I don't have any doubt that he has experience of samadhi. You know, and it's very obvious. I've been with him for 20 years. I have basically no doubt whatsoever. And you know that simply not because he says that he has these things, but because of how he talks about it. But that, of course, that's impossible to avoid that. These kind of inferences are you have to.
Have it's okay to infer, right?
Okay, to hint him in. No, I don't think you should hint.
It's not about hinting. It's just that, any average intelligent person looking at this knows clearly what this is referring to.
Sure, but that's your inference. Yeah, it's not the person speaking doesn't, and it's not doing anything wrong, right? Okay. So let's go on to the next person. When this was said, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the Venerable Revata thus, "Friend Revata, the Venerable Ananda has spoken according to his own inspiration." Patibhana means like according to his own, as it occurs to you, and kind of, you know, just speaking out. Now we ask the Venerable Revata, "Friend Revata, the Gosinga Sala tree wood is delightful. The night is moonlit, the Sala trees are all in blossom, the heavenly scents seem to be floating in the air. What kind of bhikkhu, friend Revata," bhikkhu is a monk, right, "could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood?" "Here, friend Sariputta, a bhikkhu delights in solitary meditation and takes delight in solitary meditation. He is devoted to internal serenity of mind, does not neglect meditation, possesses insight, and dwells in empty huts. That kind of bhikkhu could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood." So this is what he was famous for being a meditator, right? Delighting in solitude and all these kind of things. And this is often used together in the suttas. The idea of delighting in solitude is equivalent to delighting in meditation, basically. Solitude is patisalana in Pali. And you always see, in the suttas, as always, withdrawing into patisalana is equivalent to the practice of samadhi. These two are just two sides of the same coin. And one of the interesting things here that comes out here is that you will see that most of these terms are about samadhi, right? Solitary practice, delighting in meditation, devoted to internal serenity of mind. This is samatha, right? Serenity is samatha. Does not neglect meditation. This is anirakata jhana. So this is basically jhana. Meditation here is jhana, right? It's a bit unfortunate that this is translated in this way, because you would have no idea that what is meant here is actually the jhana. But basically it means not neglecting jhana, is what it means. So everything here is about meditation practice. The last one, dwelling in empty huts, is also about that. It's about solitude, dwelling for yourself. So everything is about that. And then you have one kind of thing which is stands out a little bit, and this is possessing insight, right? Among all these terms, which means samatha, calm, jhana, samadhi, there is insight in there. And again, it's one of those fascinating things that in the suttas, there isn't that distinction where you have like samatha on one side and vipassana on the other side, and these two are separated out as if they are completely separate ideas. They are all usually spoken of together, right? Samatha and vipassana go together. Where there is samatha, there is vipassana. Where there's vipassana, there is samatha. These things cannot be pulled apart from each other. And this is what you see here again. You have both at the same time. This is also two sides of the same coin. If you are peaceful, you have vipassana. If you have vipassana, you are peaceful. You cannot separate these things. It's such an important thing to understand. And I think I like, you know, instead of translating vipassana as insight, I think a nice translation for vipassana is clear seeing. Because insight is a bit like wisdom, it's like panya. But insight is something, or vipassana comes before panya. It was what builds up the panya, the wisdom. So it is the clear seeing. When you see things clearly, right? You see it in terms of impermanence, of suffering. This is what clear seeing is all about. And when you are calm, you see clearly. I'm sure you all know that to some extent. When you're calm and peaceful, you see things clearly. When you see things clearly, you're calm and peaceful, right? Two sides of the same coin. So again, you know, one of the most common compounds in the suttas, you know, compounds, two words stuck together, is samatha vipassana. Those two words are always stuck together. They come together as one thing. In other words, they're not really separated, right? Samatha vipassana, apart from each other. Okay, so this is what he enjoys. He thinks that kind of bhikkhu would illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood. That is Venerable Revata. When this was said, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the Venerable Anuruddha thus, "Friend Anuruddha, the Venerable Revata has spoken according to his own inspiration. Now we ask the Venerable Anuruddha, Friend Anuruddha, the Gosinga Sala tree wood is delightful, etc. The blossom, the moon is shining, all these things. What kind of bhikkhu, Friend Anuruddha, could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood? Here, Friend Sariputta, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, a bhikkhu surveys 1,000 worlds. Just as a man with good sight, when he has ascended to the upper palace chamber, might survey 1,000 wheel rims, so too, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, a bhikkhu surveys 1,000 worlds. That kind of bhikkhu could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood. So this is the divine eye. This is about being able to see things with your mind, quite literally, not with the physical eye, but with the mind. So it's almost like you send your mind out into the cosmos, right? And you see all these things that otherwise you would not be able to see. And it's interesting here, the simile that he uses. The simile he uses is a simile of a wheel rim, right? A wheel rim. And some of this sutta actually has a few parallels in Chinese, and the similes there are different, but I like the simile in the Pali, and I think perhaps this might be original. Because the simile, of course, of the wheel rim, what do we mean by 1,000 worlds? And if you know how this is described other places in the suttas, it seems very likely that what it means, it refers to perhaps solar systems, right? And a solar system is a bit like a wheel, right? It has a center, and you have the planets or whatever revolving around it. That's one possibility. Another possibility is perhaps it could refer to a galaxy. A galaxy also, you know, the spiral galaxies, they look a bit like wheels, right? And they have a center, and they kind of spiral outwards. Similar kind of thing here. So I think this might very well be what is meant here. It's a bit speculative. It's very hard to really pin it down. But that certainly fits with the simile that he uses here. This idea that he actually sees other worlds out there. And there are other suttas in the Nikayas which kind of point in a similar kind of direction. There is one place in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha talks about surveying not 1,000 worlds, but a billion worlds. And he says that each one of those worlds, it has a sun, moon, an earth, right? The Jambudipa, with the continents and the oceans, that kind of thing, and the different heavenly realms. So that seems very much to correspond to what we call a solar system, right? The sun and the planets around it. Very, very similar idea. And so it is one of those, I think, very fascinating things about the suttas, is that the Buddha seemed to have some kind of insight into the larger cosmos, basically. There are other places where it talks about the evolution and the dissolution of the world, right, or the world systems. And it's very hard to know whether this is equivalent to the Big Bang and perhaps, you know, the Big Crunch afterwards. You can just speculate. But that's what it seems like. Things that happen over vast, vast time spans and is called evolution and dissolution, it is very possible that it refers precisely to that. Right? It's astonishing. Another sutta where the Buddha says that, you know, after a long, long, long period of time, the whole earth will burn up because the heat from the sun, actually it says many suns, will be so strong that the earth burns up. And now we know that this actually is the case, right? But nobody actually knew that in those days from from physics that this is what was going to happen. And it is one of those amazing things that how these suttas 2,500 years ago actually seem to be saying things which fit quite well with modern physics and modern astronomy. To me, actually, it's quite mind-boggling how that is possible. There are no other scriptures, ancient scripture of that kind, which has these kind of descriptions in them, as far as I am aware. Anyway, and of course, this is perhaps possible if you have this kind of, you know, vast divine eye and you can see into the past by remembering your past life. Perhaps it is possible to see these kind of things directly for yourself. Yes.
Contractions and expansion did Buddha see until he got, he felt he was had enough of it? I thought it was more than 3.
Yeah, I think there's some place it says 90. Yeah. I think it says somewhere. Yeah. But, yeah.
Mm. And I said, in this expansionary phase, there were, what, how many? Six Buddha, going to be 6 Buddhas? Five so far?
Yeah, what is it? What is it now again? Is it 5 altogether? I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
And 2 in previous eons. So 5 to altogether in this one, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Sikki Vipassi, Kakusanda.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's what it is. Yeah.
Our Buddha.
Yeah. But it's all a bit legendary, all that kind of.
Legendary.
Well, particularly the future Buddha, the Maitreya, that is really legendary stuff. It only occurs in one sutta. And that sutta in that particular sutta, which has a parallel in Chinese, it does not mention Maitreya.
Oh.
So that is, the idea that there will be future Buddhas, I think, is fairly obvious. You know, that's kind of one of the, how the Dhamma works in a sense, that there will always be future Buddhas.
Yeah.
But the specific mentioning of a specific Buddha, that's very legendary here.
I see.
I would say, yeah.
So the existing, there's a 5 paths, the 5, including our own Buddha, that is in the sutta.
Yes, I wouldn't say it's a very, very strongly kind of attested thing. It's not a very important teaching. Maybe the meeting with Kassapa Buddha in the past life from the Gatikara Sutta might be one of the strongest ones. Some of the other stuff, I would say, is a bit more. It's not so important. I wouldn't place too much emphasis on that. Okay, so that is his strength, is the divine eye. So somebody seeing all these world systems out there. And of course, remember that behind this, you know, behind this idea of seeing all these world systems is, of course, a very high degree of development of the mind. It's only a very pure mind and a mind which is very powerful through the development of very deep stillness in samadhi, which is able to do this. So there's something very beautiful going on here at the same time. It's not just kind of this seeing all this world and that's it. There's something much more going on behind that. So please keep that in mind.
A challenge to modern science?
Maybe they should actually employ some monks to kind of see this world. That would be cool, wouldn't it? And they say, actually, look in this direction.
Oh, well, I can't help but to think that this is a challenge to modern science.
Yeah. I don't think it's a challenge in the sense that it's not different necessarily, but it might be useful.
Much more clearly, in terms of resolving.
Yeah. And they can maybe point them to interesting things or whatever. Yeah. I'm not sure how many monks these days do this kind of stuff, but anyway. Or nuns, or anyone for that matter. But yeah. Okay, when this was said, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the Venerable Mahakassapa thus, "Friend Kassapa, the Venerable Anuruddha has spoken according to his own inspiration. Now we ask the Venerable Mahakassapa, Friend Kassapa, the Gosinga sal tree wood is delightful. What kind of bhikkhu, friend Kassapa, could illuminate this Gosinga sala tree wood? Here, friend Sariputta, a bhikkhu is a forest dweller himself and speaks in praise of forest dwelling. He is an alms food eater himself and speaks in praise of eating alms food. He is a refuse rag wearer himself and speaks in praise of wearing refuse rag robes. He is a triple robe wearer himself and speaks in praise of wearing the triple robe. He has few wishes himself and speaks in praise of fewness of wishes. He is content himself and speaks in praise of contentment. He is secluded himself and speaks in praise of seclusion. He is aloof from society himself and speaks in praise of aloofness from society. He is energetic himself and speaks in praise of arousing energy. He has attained to virtue himself and speaks in praise of the attainment of virtue. He has attained samadhi himself and speaks in praise of the attainment of samadhi, here called concentration, stillness perhaps. He has attained to wisdom himself and speaks in praise of the attainment of wisdom. He has attained the deliverance himself, freedom himself, and speaks in praise of the attainment of freedom. He has attained to the knowledge and vision of freedom, deliverance himself, and speaks in praise of the attainment of the knowledge and vision of deliverance. That kind of bhikkhu could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood. So, wow, that's a bit of a list there. You have this really long list of qualities that are mentioned in here. And, of course, as I mentioned before, Mahakasapa, he was famous for his particular for being quite ascetic. I think I may have mentioned that before. That was one of the things that he was quite well known for. So that is why you see here at the beginning of this list, you see these more or less ascetic practices that he's doing. Living in the forest, right? Eating alms food. That means usually going on alms round, not going to houses and to invitations, that sort of thing. He wears refuse rag wearer. In other words, you find cloth on the ground somewhere, discarded cloth. You go to the charnel ground. You take the cloth off the corpse. Right? There's a good story about that in the suttas. Not in the suttas, in the Vinaya. There's a monk who just lives just like this. He lives. He takes the cloth off the corpses on the charnel ground. The charnel ground is where they chuck out the corpse and it kind of lies there and rots right at the charnel ground. Sometimes you might burn the corpse, and sometimes if the corpse is quite fresh, the cloth might still be good, right? So you go and you take the cloth off this corpse, right, and then you make it into a robe or whatever. But if the corpse is very fresh, right? Maybe the consciousness hasn't left yet. So if you take the cloth off the corpse, but it's so fresh, the consciousness still is attached, maybe the corpse gets upset, right? Maybe it doesn't like it. And this is the story in the Vinaya. This is the Vinaya, is that you go to this corpse, and he takes the cloth off, right? And when he takes the cloth off, the corpse says, "Don't take the cloth off my body." And as he walks away, the corpse rises up and he walks behind him, right? And this monk hurries off, to get away from this corpse. It's pretty scary if a corpse comes walking behind you. And then he kind of rushes into his kuti. And then when he rushes into his kuti, the corpse kind of falls flat, outside his kuti. And then according to the story, the Buddha lays down a rule that you're not supposed to take cloth off a corpse that is too fresh. It shouldn't be too fresh because then you fall into this danger. It's ownership, right? If you are still alive, you think this is my clothes. It's like if you come to me and said, "Oh, I'd like some piece of your robe," I wouldn't be too happy. And it's the same kind of thing, right? So it's a nice story. I don't know if it's true. It's in one of the kind of smaller sections in the Vinaya somewhere, but perhaps it is true. It's a neat story. I like that one. Yes.
Logistic in terms of Vinaya like that, the monks are very well spread out during the time of Buddha. So
yeah.
In the Anga region and so on.
Yeah.
Buddha may be at Savatthi or maybe in the Rajagaha or whatever.
Yeah.
And when he enacted a new Vinaya,
yeah.
So how is that propagated to?
It will be propagated slowly, because.
So there will be for a period whereby. Yeah. Some monks will not be observing this.
That's true. That could well be the case. And then gradually it will kind of spread out. Because one of the things about the monks and nuns in those days, they would move around quite a bit. So because they would move around from one area to another one, it wouldn't be that long before, you know, these things would spread around from one community to another one. So it would probably happen fairly fast because of all the movement of the monastics. Probably faster than you think, probably. Yeah. But yes, it's true. There would probably be a time when you know, people might still break the rule until actually it was new by the time. Yeah, that's true. And they might be by themselves for months on end. Yeah.
So I wonder, to solve that inconvenience, whether this is by mind communication.
I don't think so. I think the main communication is the Patimokkha recitation. And that every fortnight you're supposed to go to Patimokkha. Even if you're forest dweller, you should ideally go to a community where there is a recitation of the Patimokkha. And because these are communities, you know, that's often where information would come in fairly fast from the outside, because you are a community in a certain place. So I suspect that the system is such, it would actually happen fairly fast. I don't think mind-to-mind communication probably is the most... Yeah, I don't think that's how they would do it.
I'd like to have a more physical explanation.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so you have all these ascetic practices that he is doing, and of course not just that, but you have all these other beautiful qualities here: the fewness of wishes, the contentment, seclusion, and then towards the end, all the attainments that you require to reach full awakening, right? And it ends with the attainment of knowledge and vision of deliverance. And what that means is just that when you attain awakening in Buddhism, it's not something that, you know, am I awakened, am I not? You know, it doesn't work like that. You know that you have reached awakening, right? You know this is the end of rebirth. So there is a knowledge there. The knowledge of awakening always comes with awakening itself. These things are two sides, again, of the same coin. And one of the things you will notice with this list as well, which is quite nice, is that you practice it, and you speak in praise of these things, right? So this is kind of an aspect of virtue in Buddhism, is that you not only do you do them yourself, but you also speak in praise of these things. You are kind, and you speak in praise of kindness, right? And of course, the basic thing, of course, is to do the practice yourself, but you actually improve your virtue by also teaching these things. Teaching is an important part of the monastic or any Buddhist life, really. That's part of it. And of course, just teaching without having done the practice, of course, that doesn't really work either. So these two things complement each other very nicely. One of the things which I think is a kind of important to keep in mind as well, here there is a bit of praise of these ascetic practices. There are also other ascetic practices that are more severe than this. But one of the things about the ascetic practices is that they are often more talked about in later literature and not so emphasized in the suttas. The sutta emphasis is always about the middle way, right? Not torturing yourself, not indulging in sensuality, nor torturing yourself. It's this middle way where the body kind of disappears. The body is unimportant. But then later on in the in later literature, for example, in the Visuddhimagga especially, they talk in great detail about ascetic practices, much more about them. And they seem to praise them and lift them up much more. And it's kind of strange. The Buddha doesn't really talk about it, but later on. And I think maybe there is kind of a tendency in the human mind to move towards ascetic practices. It seems very impressive, right, when somebody is really ascetic. And so there tends to be a movement that way. But actually, the real progress on the path is when you find that right middle way between the two extremes. Yes?
Traditionally, I was taught that Vera Mahakaspa really practiced those 13, you know, ascetic practice till really late in his life, until he could say he can stop, but he doesn't want to stop.
Yeah.
So is that still... historically,
there is some basis for that. There are some suttas where the Mahakasapa says, I think it's in the Kassapa Sanyutta, in the Sanyutta Nikaya, where he says that I still practice the forest dwelling, I still practice the wearing of the triple robe, these things. And he says, why? Well, because I had compassion for later generations. That's one of the main reasons. In other words, you set the example, right? And when you set the example, later generations will think, wow, these really good monks in the past, they did this, I should do it too. And of course, there are some of these ascetic practices which are quite okay, because they're not really all that ascetic. like dwelling in the forest is okay if you have a reasonable nice cootie. Wearing, you know, rag robe is not a very difficult thing to do. As long as it covers your body and keeps you warm, it's okay. It just looks a bit ugly or whatever, but so what, you know?
Doesn't lie down?
Well, that is another one. That is an ascetic practice you don't really see in the suttas at all. It's mentioned in a couple of places. But that is much more ascetic, right? In a very different way. You never actually lie down, you always sit up. And that is where I would say you very quickly you move into the territory of torturing yourself if you never lie down. And I know some monks who have done that, and they basically destroy their meditation as a consequence. So you have to be very, very careful with these kind of practices.
So in other words, it seems that he's not, when he talks about the ascetic practice in that context, it's not talking about the 13...
No, the 13 Dutangas, that is very much a commentarial thing that you find in the Visuddhimagga. It's much, very much so. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so that is Mahakasapa. And so that is what he has to say. And then move on to the next one. When this was said, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the Venerable Mahamoggallana. Friend Moggallana, the Venerable Mahakasapa has spoken according to his own inspiration. Now we ask the Venerable Mahamoggallana, Friend Moggallana, the Gosinga Sala tree wood is delightful, etc. What kind of monk, Friend Moggallana, would illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood? Here, Friend Sariputta, two monks engage in talk on the higher Dhamma, and they question each other, and each being questioned by the other answers without foundering, and the talk rolls on in accordance with the Dhamma. That kind of bhikkhu could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood. So here you have the Venerable Mahamoggallana talking about Dhamma discussion, really, as being the kind of thing which inspires him. And this is quite unusual, right? Usually, Mahamoggallana, when we talk about him, usually we're talking about psychic powers. I'll be with you in a second. Usually we talk about psychic power. That is what he is famous for. But here, he's famous for something else, for discussing the Dhamma. And the interesting thing here is that the parallel to these suttas in the Chinese tradition, they actually talk about Mahamoggallana here, that what he talks about is psychic powers. So the question then is, well, which one is more original? And it is possible that the Chinese version might be more original because it is more natural to talk about Mahamoggallana in that connection. But it's also possible that this is more original. And the reason for that is because it is an unusual thing, right? You don't really expect that. And unusual things don't normally creep in. Normally, it is the standard things that tend to creep into the suttas. And the unusual things tend not to creep in. And this is a principle in what they call, you know, when you read these texts and you want to find out what is the real thing, it is a principle that is used to decide that kind of issues. And this is called the principle of the more difficult or the more unusual reading is more likely to be true. And this is what they use in biblical studies. And in biblical studies, they had many different versions of the Bible, and they had to decide, well, which one is right, which one is wrong, which passage can we trust, which can't we trust. And then these are the principles that were used to decide in biblical studies what was the more original reading. They call the principle of the more unusual reading is more likely to be true, because unusual readings, they don't creep in, right? They are either there from the beginning, and then they tend to be standardized, but the other way around is more unlikely. Anyway, that's just to give you some idea of how these, what they call text-critical studies, how that is done on the suttas and also on other texts. It is possible that this is the right reading. It's also possible that the other one is the right one. It's hard to really come to any final conclusion. And here they have talk on the higher Dhamma. The higher Dhamma here is the Abhidhamma, right? The Abhidhamma meaning usually in Buddhism, the Abhidhamma means like the seven books of the Abhidhamma, the third Pitaka. That's usually what it means. But here it doesn't mean that, because that third Pitaka, Abhidhamma, didn't exist yet at this particular point. And the most usual understanding of this is that it actually just means with reference to the Dhamma. So talk about the Dhamma, basically. Talk with reference to the Dhamma. And they question each other. This is one of those important things in the suttas, one of the kind of basic things that again lead to understanding of the Dhamma, is the idea of having discussions about the Dhamma. It's often called Dhamma Sakaccha, where you discuss these issues. Or here it's called Dhamma Katta. Katta means talk about the Dhamma, but it's also implied discussion in this. This is one of those basic things that carry along the path, listening to the Dhamma, but also discussing it. Or discussion often just means asking questions, right? And not being just a passive, someone who passively takes in the suttas, but actually ask questions about that. There is a danger there. If you are too passive in your engagement with the Dhamma, then often you sit there and you listen, but because of that passivity, often you don't learn as much as if you engage more actively. If you ask questions, if you kind of actively engage, often you learn much more because it makes you think when you actively engage with these things. So I always recommend you to, if you can, to ask questions and to engage a bit more, because that actually usually helps the learning process. So that is what you are seeing here. So they are then talking about this. They're answering without foundering because they have a profound and understanding of the Dhamma. These are the Aryans again, no doubt, that he's talking about. And that's why you know the Dhamma directly from the heart, right? And sometimes you feel that. Sometimes you feel that people talk from the heart. And there's some profundity about that Dhamma when people talk from the heart. It's like you can feel that there's some truth to this. There's something very powerful going on. It's not often that you hear that, but sometimes you hear people who, wow, this is really, there's something going on here, which is unusual, which you normally don't hear from most people. People, it kind of comes out of them. The Dhamma sort of streams out, right? It's like they are the Dhamma almost. They have kind of embody the Dhamma teachings. And what a powerful thing that is. And this is one of the reasons that I have to admit that I was attracted to Ajahn Brahm's teachings, first of all. Because when I heard his teachings, I felt, well, this is not kind of knowledge. He's not reading from a book. It's kind of just coming out of him, right? And you hear some of those talks, when he talks at the monastery about meditation and things. And he's been doing this for a long time now. There's something very powerful about that, something very real. Real to a degree which is very hard to often find in the world. So that I think is part of what is going on here. Sorry, I let you wait for a long time. Do you still have a question or? Yes. Say again. The.
You read that passage.
Yeah.
Did
I?
The Bodhisattva
says that now we ask Lenda Mahamogulana, friend Mahamogulana, the Gosinga Sala wood, Sala tree wood is delightful, etc. Yeah. Well, it has three dots. Yeah, in the text. It's elided because it's the same. Every passage, is, for every person, it's the same thing. So they have just elided some of the text, not to make it so repetitive. Yeah. Yeah, okay, sure. It probably is so even in the original, in the actual Pali as well. Very often it is elided. And they have a little word in Pali called payala, which actually means etc. in Pali. So you have etc. in Pali as well. Yes.
When it's said repeatedly here that the wood is delightful.
Yeah.
Does it seem to, people who are at least attracted to practice, that when this word delightful is there because of the presence of so many great arahants,
yeah,
it's not just a delightful King's Park, that maybe the environment is quite powerful?
Well, yes, I mean,
because
I think,
sometimes when I meet supposedly well-practiced monk, I do feel that the whole environment is very, very quiet.
Sure, yeah. Well, the word delight is very multifaceted, right? You can delight in many different things. You can delight in sensual pleasures. You can delight in so many different things. So it's important here to understand it's the right kind of delight. It's delight in nature, right? Delight in natural phenomena. It probably is very, very quiet, but it is the right kind of delight. And this is what you find also with the Buddha in the, you know, when the Buddha before his awakening here. And this is kind of the nice thing about the Buddha. Before his awakening, he decides to give up all the ascetic practices. And then after, not ascetic, but the self-tormenting, the torturing practices, a much more accurate way of putting it, than ascetic practices, he decides to give up torturing himself. And then where does he go? He goes to a delightful grove, right? With smooth banks, with a clear flowing river nearby here, and a beautiful grove for practicing meditation, right? It all sounds almost sensual. Huh? With a view, it doesn't say anything about the, doesn't say anything about the view, huh? But it is in the forest. It probably isn't much of a, that much of a view. Huh? But the point is that, and this is kind of the point here, is that, you know, he is now discovered the middle way here. So, you know, a nice place which is comfortable and has all the facilities that he requires is what this actually means. The river is there for bathing. There's a village nearby for alms, right? But it's quiet enough to practice. And it is delightful. And one of the things that you find throughout the suttas is precisely this delight in nature throughout the suttas. And I think the idea there is that nature in itself already is kind of, it's already moving you in the right direction. It's a type of, it is, there's some aspect of sensuality there, because you're taking these things through your eyes, of course, but it's a kind of a sensuality. Maybe sensuality is probably far too strong a word, but there's a type of sensual input which leads towards peace and leads towards tranquility and takes in the right way. So that is what you're delighting in there. So you have to, yeah, you have to, these words are ambivalent in English. They're also ambivalent in Pali. They can mean delighting in the wrong way and delighting in the right way. I think garati is the word in Pali here, I think, but I'm not entirely sure. Okay. Sorry? Somebody have a question? Yes. Wayne? Yeah.
Even though he was foremost in psychic powers and abilities, he also helped teach the students after Venerable Sariputta to realize that he must have been very good at discussion and teaching and all that kind of side of it as well, which would correspond to this kind of translation.
Exactly, I would agree with you. I think it's too simple just to equate them with the most obvious quality. I would agree with that. And we see that next one is Venerable Sariputta, and it's the same thing. He's not actually, he doesn't praise wisdom. He praises meditation practice. It's a similar kind of thing here. So when this was said, the Venerable Maha Moggallana addressed the Venerable Sariputta thus, "Friend Sariputta, we have all spoken according to our own inspiration. Now we ask the Venerable Sariputta, Friend Sariputta, the Gosinga Sala tree wood is delightful. The night is moonlit. The Sala trees are all in blossom. The heavenly scents seem to be floating in the air. What kind of monk, Friend Sariputta, could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood?" So now we are coming really, we're going up the hierarchy, right? The kind of more and more important monks. Now it's Venerable Sariputta, who is next in wisdom only to the Buddha himself. "Here, friend Moggallana, a bhikkhu wields mastery over his mind. He does not let the mind will mastery over him. In the morning he abides in whatever abiding or attainment he wants to abide in during the morning. At midday he abides in whatever abiding or attainment he wants to abide in at midday. And in the evening he abides in whatever abiding or attainment he wants to abide in during the evening. Suppose a king or king's minister had a chest full of variously colored garments. In the morning he could put on whatever pair of garments he wanted to put on in the morning. At midday, he could put on whatever pair of garments he wanted to put on at midday. In the evening, he could put on whatever pair of garments he wanted to put on in the evening. So too, a bhikkhu wields mastery over his mind. He does not let the mind wield mastery over him." And then the whole thing is repeated. "That kind of bhikkhu could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood." So this wielding mastery over the mind means basically attaining any kind of samadhi state you like, right? Any kind of samadhi, whatever jhana, immaterial attainment,
full cessation of everything, or you have these other types of samadhis, the animitta samadhi, the markless, signless samadhi, all of these things. You are able at any time to attain these things. And this is one of those qualities that is mentioned in the suttas as being something you practice towards, right? Having full mastery over this samadhi practice. So whenever you come in here to meditate, you know, whatever it is, you can enter whatever peace you want, right? And often it isn't like that, right? Often you, some days it works well, other days it doesn't. But if you have mastery over the mind, you always have that ability to attain these things. And of course, it only really works when you attain full awakening, you abandon all the defilements, because it is the defilements, the hindrances, that block you from actually attaining these things in the first place. And the sutta speak of, you know, the ability to attain whatever samadhi you like, at whatever time you like, to come out when you want, to be skilled in the samadhis in various types of ways. And of course, one of the things that is interesting here, and this, you know, from what Wayne was just saying, is that usually Venerable Sariputta, he is famous for his wisdom, right? He is the wisest person next to the Buddha. So again, you see here this connection between wisdom. Before it was vipassana and samatha, now it's a connection between wisdom and states of samadhi, states of jhana, etc., etc. These things always go together, and here also they go together. The wisest person is precisely the one who is able to attain these deep states of samadhi. So again, because you know, wisdom here means, and basically wisdom means understanding the mind, right? Understanding how you work, having an insight into how these things function. Because that is really having wisdom into who you are as a person, mind, body, etc. Because that is what wisdom is. That is what enables you then to go into samadhi as well. So these things go together. Yes?
About being able to achieve jhanas in different ways and whatever you are. But isn't also, in a more broad way, just about being versatile in your practice, knowing what is proper and given the conditions where you are? Isn't also the message? Because all the other monks, they try to frame under their own strengths, but then the higher you go, as you're saying, you're going, the next one is Buddha himself. And then you come with this a very versatile message,
right?
Like, just like if it's cold, you wear something to warm you. If it's not cold, you wear something that's light. That's what he's saying.
Sure. Yeah. I think that's probably something to that. You have versatility because there are certain things that are appropriate at certain times, right? I mean, sometimes you have certain duties that you have to fulfill, or certain teachings you have to give, or whatever, and then you know the right attainment to be able to actually optimize that sort of thing. You know, if you go into Nirodha Samapatti, ending of all things, and you stay in there for 7 days, you might miss a few appointments on the way, right? So that is part of it, right? And you don't want to be so peaceful that you can't talk, right? So I think that is very, very true as well. You have versatility, and you know the right attainment for the right time, and all these kind of things. Sure. Yeah. Okay. So time is going fast. So let us come now. We can move towards the end of this sutta. Then the Venerable Sariputta addressed those venerable ones thus: "Friends, we have all spoken according to our own inspiration. Let us go to the Blessed One and report this matter to him. As the Blessed One answers, so let us remember it." "Yes, friend," they replied. Then those venerable ones went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they sat down at one side. And the Venerable Sariputta said to the Blessed One. And now, basically, I'm not going to read this because it's going to take too long, but basically he just repeats everything that has happened to the Buddha. And when he does so, the Buddha says, he replies in each case, he says, good, Sariputta, Ananda, Ananda, and then Revata, whatever, speaking rightly, should speak just as he did, because Ananda has learned much, he remembers what he has learned, etc., etc. So he basically says that it is good that you have spoken in this way, because basically, you know, they have these qualities, they know what they are, and so they have spoken according to their own understanding, basically. That's what the Buddha says to each one of them. And then, coming to the very end of the sutta, Venerable Sariputta says, when this was said, the Venerable Sariputta asked the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, which of us has spoken well?" Right? Which ones of us have said the, you know, said something useful and good? And the Buddha replies, perhaps not very surprisingly, "You have all spoken well, Sariputta, each in his own way." Right? So there's many ways in which you can illuminate the sala tree wood. All of these things kind of come back to the same thing. They come back to wisdom. They come back to understanding. They come back to meditation ability. But there are different angles, right, on the same thing, basically. It's possible to talk about these things in many different ways. But hear also from me, what kind of monk could illuminate this Gosinga sala tree wood? Hear, Sariputta, when a monk has returned from his arms round after his meal, he sits down, folds his legs crosswise, sets his body erect, and establishing mindfulness in front of him, he resolves, "I shall not break the sitting position until, through not clinging, my mind is liberated from the taints." That kind of bhikkhu could illuminate this Gosinga sala tree wood. So that is the Buddha's reply, right? And you can see here, there's almost like a subtle shift in what's happening. Most of the monks here, they have talked about almost like attainments, right? The divine eye, the deep attainments of samadhi, or etc., etc. They have talked about kind of things that have been attained by these by themselves or possibly by others. But the Buddha, instead of looking at qualities that you have attained or you have achieved, the Buddha changes the focus from the result of the path to the actual practice of the path itself. It's a subtle change, but it's nice, right? Because in the end, all of us, we need to focus on the practice. And if we are practicing rightly in a good way, that means that we are doing what is right. If you focus too much on the results, you're not going to get anywhere. You have to focus on what I need to do now. And so the Buddha makes his shift from the results and brings it back down to what we need to do. There's a very powerful message there, because all practice is really like that. People often worry too much about the results. They say, "Oh, when would I get to jhana? You know, I've been doing this for, you know, I don't know how many years, 20 years or whatever. I still haven't gotten a deep samadhi," right? And it's that worry about the results which is the problem. Instead of worrying about the result, we need to just focus on the conditions that will eventually lead to the results. We have to enjoy doing the conditions, enjoy being kind, enjoy being generous, enjoy just sitting there peacefully, right? And if you enjoy those things, then the results will come. But if you think too much about the marvelous samadhi you might attain, then it's much more difficult to enjoy what you're doing now, because your mind is already on something else which you really want, right? Because you crave for that, you can't enjoy what you have. So enjoy what you have. This is so important. Focus on that. Then you will move towards something which actually is worthwhile, would happen by itself. Otherwise, we destroy what we're doing now. So that shift, I think, is very powerful and very significant, the shift away from result, but shifting, and of course, looking at the actual practice itself. Of course, the kind of practice the Buddha has in mind here is not the kind of practice you would recommend to the vast majority of people, because it is not going to give results, basically. And to understand what the Buddha is saying here, you need to look at the introductory phrase here. He says, when a bhikkhu has returned from his arms round after his meal, he sits down, folds his legs crosswise, sets his body erect, and establishing mindfulness in front of him, he resolves. Now that initial part here is important. Without that initial part, the rest at the bottom doesn't really it's hard to, you know, without that initial part, the resolve becomes pointless. So the point here is that he is able to establish mindfulness, right? In other words, it refers to somebody who is already practicing very well. It doesn't refer to just anybody. It says here, establishing mindfulness in front of you. Well, establishing mindfulness in front of you is not something you can just do. You can't just say, I will be mindful. Mindfulness itself happens because of cause and conditions. This is just so important, right? People say, oh yeah, I must be mindful, I'm not mindful enough. Well, you can't really control that. You can't just say, I will be more mindful. You have to put in place the cause and conditions. And those cause and conditions are, again, coming back to what I said before, the virtue, the kindness, all the goodness you do during your life. That is the causes and the conditions for mindfulness to be possible. Because if you have those things, you will feel good. You will feel happy about yourself. Because you're happy about yourself, your mind will naturally come into the present moment, and mindfulness is there. This is how it works. So establishing mindfulness, that is kind of 90% of the path, right? And if you are able to establish mindfulness, it means that samadhi will happen. Mindfulness comes, and samadhi comes as a function of that mindfulness. It's always the same thing on the path. Mindfulness, then samadhi, one thing after the other. These are not contrasting things, either mindfulness or samadhi. They are phenomena that, you know, condition each other, one coming after the other. So once you have mindfulness, because you are in the present moment already, because you already have established a sense of joy in the present moment, happiness about who you are, etc., then when you meditate, it flows smoothly. You don't have to worry. There's no thinking. There's no maybe tiny bit of thinking, very little, right? There's not going into the future, going into the past. There's no craving. There's no sloth and torpor. There's no anger or ill will. And there's not all this desire stuff which keeps us messing us around all the time. You are here. You're present. You're feeling peaceful already. That is the kind of person who is then able to move on and to make this kind of resolve. If you haven't got that, then there's no point in even, you know, it's impossible to make this kind of resolve. It's completely pointless. It's complete madness, in fact, to make this kind of resolve. And if you aren't mad already, you will become so quickly if you try this sort of thing here. Yeah. I know, as Abraham said, apparently, when he was young, while he was still at university, he said that he did that. He thought, yeah, you know, I've read about in the suttas that you're supposed to sit down and resolve and just, you know, sit down until you're fully enlightened. And I think he lasted for half an hour gritting his teeth, you know, because you're not really used to sitting cross-legged, right? So it's all very painful and very bad. So that is the wrong way. So, and then, of course, once all of those things are in place, you have the samadhi, you have the mindfulness, then you can say, I shall not break the sitting posture. It probably means that you're already an Arya as well. You're already a stream entry, right? That's probably what it means as well. So you already understand the Dhamma. Then you can say this, I shall not break this posture until I reach full awakening. Yeah. Right? The really determined monk, it says here. Yeah. That kind of monk could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood. Does that make sense? Yes, sir.
So does it mean that resolution came because psychologically it's feeling that time is right for this last heroic hit?
Yeah, probably it is about understanding that the time has come and you feel that you are ready for making the breakthrough, all the conditions are right, and then when you know that the time is sort of right, then you go for it. Yeah, I would say that's a good way of looking at it. Yeah, yeah. So that is good. Yes, John, you have to use the microphone, so you have to wait.
It's just a point on the stream winner. You're saying the stream winner has to would reach these qualities, but in the suttas there seem to be different types of stream winners. There were some who were married, and so they would not have reached yeah. They would have not reached that area.
It says here it says a bhikkhu, right?
But you said the word stream winner.
I didn't want to mention that because I thought, you know, maybe it's not necessary. But actually, it says here that a bhikkhu resolves this, right? That's what it says in the sutta. And the reason for that could be precisely that if you live a married life, it's not going to be very conducive to full awakening. You might be able to become a stream winner. You might be able to go a bit further if you practice really well. But full awakening for a householder, it can happen, but usually it happens on your deathbed, because on your deathbed you're letting go of everything, and that's when arahantship can happen for a householder. And once you become an arahant anyway, you're no longer a householder. You've given all that up. Mentally, you're no longer a householder, right? You've given up all that. You can't really store things up, as it says in the suttas, as you did previously. Yeah.
So, sir, that wasn't what I really meant. What I meant was, you said those signs of the bhikkhu would be an arya, a stream winner, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But in the time of the Buddhas, there were already stream winners who were married and lived the lay life.
Yeah.
So would they could they do that?
You would have to have two factors. You had to be a bhikkhu and you had to be a stream enter, yeah.
But in the time of the Buddha, there were stream winners who were lay people.
Yes, that's true. But they are excluded from this. That's what I say, because you are maybe not 100% excluded, but I would say largely excluded, because if you still live lay life, it is very unlikely you will have even the possibility to do this kind of thing, you know? So maybe not, maybe I'm being a little bit over the top. Maybe it is possible, and then you become a monk afterwards, you know, once you attain that, it is conceivable. But I think usually this is a reference to monastics probably, yeah? You know, you see in the suttas, you talk about, the highest type of wisdom, for example, for the monastics, and compare that to the lay people. And the highest type of wisdom for the lay people is always the anagami, whereas for the monastics, it's the arahant, right? Because once you're an arahant, you are a monastic, but almost, Okay. Anything else? Yes. Drew, yeah.
Thanks, hey John. Just a quick one. What was the name of that sutta that you mentioned before about the virtue sutta?
It's the Salayaka Sutta, Majjhima 41. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a standard set of about talking about virtue, and it is found many, many places in the suttas, but that is one where it is very, very obvious one.
I better read up.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Have a look at that one. Yeah, Majjhima 41. Yeah.
Bhante,
yes. Okay. Over there. Yeah.
Just in line with what you said, just to put things in context, the suttas is in a very specific vaga, very clearly depicting teachings from the Buddha to the Bhikkhu Sangha, inspiring them into reaching the goal. So I think that your point is quite correct. Yeah, you might have stream enterers, winners who are not bhikkhus, but the specific instruction.
Sure. Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. It seems to be an instruction to the monks, basically, and presumably also the nuns may be in a similar kind of position. But it's not the kind of teaching that you would normally give to lay people. That's not usually not the way things work in the suttas. Okay. Anyone else? Everybody else happy? Okay. So the final sentence of the sutta. This is what the Blessed One said, and those venerable ones were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Okay. Very good. Okay, so let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.